You know what that sound means? Welcome to your Netflix Quarterly, the much ado, much hyped about, and it's finally here. Once again, we are back to Mike, and Oscar. I am your host, Mike. This is my co-host, also Mike.
I am also Mike. I'm hyped to be here. Long anticipated Netflix Quarterly.
Once per episode at the beginning, I try to come up with words that I don't firmly have in my vocabulary yet, and I like dance around the word, and then you say it with ease. And that's what makes us a good team, I think.
Absolutely.
But yes, anticipation is the word I could not come up with. Much anticipation, much hype between the two of us. If we've promised this over and over again, it is not quite mid-April, so we're basically at a quarterly pace.
Yeah, we're hitting it. We're hitting the timing. Hitting the programming scheduling. I'm very proud of you, Mike.
Of course, I haven't edited this yet, and it is WrestleMania weekend, so that remains to be seen. Apologies once again. You might hear the clitter clatter of my dog in the background, but we are here, Mike, and Oscar, doing Netflix Quarterly. We had our Netflix Year in Review last year that came out in late November. Kind of a big hit for us, so we decided to chop it up. Instead of taking Netflix in totality of the year 2018, we would chop it up, hopefully in four episodes, and kind of look back at what the streaming service has to offer in both more so movies, since that's what we do here, but we also do touch on television shows in the first 3 months of 2018.
Yes, January, February, March, those are the first 3 months of every year,
they
correct?
Are, in fact, the first right, 3 months, good. Not only up, but also of 2018. We teach as well as express in this podcast.
Yes, it's very important part of the pod. We are going to count almost 40 reviews for you here today. We're going to do a deep dive into two big movies that we think are going to be the, you know, the centerpiece of the finishing touches on
the episode.
We're
cheating a little bit with one of them, but yes.
And otherwise, we got some TV reviews, we got some 2017 callbacks, and then we're going to rip off Netflix original movies for these last 3 months for you, and I'm pretty excited.
Yeah, it's Mike just described it to you, but it's going to be pretty much the same format. If you didn't go listen to our first Netflix Year in Review for 2017, you can go check that out, but we had, again, about 40-ish films that we kind of ripped through, gave quick takes on. It's going to be the same, since Netflix has come out with so much already in 2018. Mm. We're going to have the same type of format here. We're going to start going quickly through the TV shows, just highlight some of them that we've been watching and some of our favorites. We'll move our way through the Netflix original films, and then again, like Mike said, we'll highlight the two biggies at the end that we think could possibly be up for Oscar consideration come next March.
Yeah, I think there's some possibilities there. If they get some momentum, we'll see. Technical categories, perhaps. I think that they're worthy to be discussed. So, yeah, TV.
Lot to get to. Let's start it off. Also, Mike's going to start. We're going to knock out about six or seven TV shows, let you know what we're watching.
Cool. So, Black Mirror Season 4. You know,
you're a big fan.
Appointment viewing. I mean, pound for pound, episode to episode, perhaps the best season yet, Michael.
Really?
U.S. Callister just start us off with the sci-fi twist. I loved it with Fat Damon. I mean, he's terrific. Black Museum.
Poor Jesse Plemons.
Jesse Plemons, he's great. Black Museum, Hang the DJ, also great.
A lot of critical episodes. Acclaim as well. Every new Black Mirror episode, it seems like the Varieties and Deadline Hollywoods, they all had their takes on them.
I thought Crocodile showcased the star-making performance from Andrea Riseborough. She was in Battle of the Sexes.
Yeah, she played
Emma Stone's girlfriend in that. Yeah,
Billie Jean King's lover. She was fantastic in that as well.
So, Mike, you did Dirty Money.
Dirty Money. Look, life sucks and existence is pain, right? I mean, I wasn't overly impressed. It's a documentary series about, it starts off talking about the Volkswagen scandal from 2016, how they lied to get their cars through the emissions test, and it talks about basically the trickle-down effect of economics and where it stands in America today. It's sad. It sucks. It's a sad reality for a lot of people. I wasn't overly impressed with it. I've seen better documentary-type shows about similar issues and the plight of the diminishing lower and middle class in America. Nothing too exotic, just current and updated. So if that's good enough for you, if you need to see what it's been like in 2018, 2017, and where we stand today, then yeah, definitely check it out. Otherwise, not crazy, not too overwhelmed with it, especially in comparison to other stuff we have. What'd you have next?
The End of the Effing World. I loved it. I thought both leads do a terrific job. Essentially, it's a road trip movie, but like an effed up kind of serial killery premise. I'm not going to give it away, but it's two high school kids running away from home, and they're being hunted down, so it's got a chase element to it. Dark comedy, pitch black. It jumps sharks in fun ways. So TV, like very televisionally.
Sounds like, well, that's definitely a word. Sounds like something that's right up my alley, though. I can deal with murder and dark humor.
Yeah, I mean, you can enjoy this if you like a little madness in your TV. I mean, I was a fan. They're also 20 minutes long, each episode. So it's like 20 minutes of crazy, move on, 20 right. minutes of a different kind of crazy. It was fun. Mike, you did the Joel McHale show with Joel McHale.
So it's Talk Soup. It's just a rebooted Talk Soup. And I'm pretty sure they said, look, Joel, just show up. I don't care what you wear. It doesn't matter. You could talk about anything, as he has clips from as far back as the 80s in the premiere episode.
Really?
But yeah, it's awesome to see Joel McHale back in his comfort zone doing what it is that I think he does best, which is dryly judging everybody from his faux high horse. That is when he's in front of a green screen while doing it. What I think Netflix is sneaky doing with this, though, I think there's an ulterior motive to this type of programming.
Really?
Because this type of programming is, by necessity, by the layout of it, by the premise of it, you can only release an episode per week, right?
Right.
Because it's a week in review for pop culture and television showing.
Yeah.
So they need to go week by week. I think Netflix might be easing into a weekly release schedule with this one for their bigger shows. I think this might be their first foray into getting out of the binge all our new content territory, where they have these content dumps of the new season of Arrested Development.
Go more the Hulu.
Yeah, exactly. The sustained, the prolonged gratification route. The show itself, it's Talk Soup. It's great. It's hilarious. Gabriel Iglesias was on the first episode, made a guest appearance. It's exactly
fluffy.
What you think it is. Yeah, it was high comedy. Definitely check it out.
So I did Collateral. This was the...
Was Tom Cruise or Jamie Foxx in this?
No, this was the Carey Mulligan. She's a pregnant detective.
I would still watch it if she was playing the Tom Cruise role, yes.
Yeah, she's good in this. I wish this focused more on her and made this a whodunit, just stuck with Carey Mulligan.
Sure.
Because I thought like all the extraneous narratives about all these other characters kind of was just boring to me. I wish they just focused it a little better, but I still binged it in 2 days, so it had some merits. It delivered some
That's
goods.
How you know you're entering true critic role, you know?
Oh, yeah?
It was all right. I took it all down in a matter of hours.
Yeah, it's like the guy who finishes the meal and the dish is completely
clean. The steak was overcooked.
Yeah, I didn't like it.
Sir, I believe the steak was underdone, but did you have to eat the entire thing before?
Spotless plate. So yeah, so I did. I had a spotless plate at the end of it. Mike, you did Trump the American Dream.
I'm not going to go where you think I'm going to go with this, but it was really good. It's really captivating. I think it's impartial. It shows interviews with both people that have known Donald Trump since he was a young kid to news reporters that had to cover him for the New York Times and other magazines
right.
and periodicals that he has had issues with over the years.
You have better liberal bubble radar than I do, and you thought it was more impartial?
I'm not as untainted as you think, and I know a lot of friends would agree with that. I tried to see it as impartial. I think it was. You get definitely both sides of the coin.
Okay.
It's interesting to hear the behind the scenes and coming of age issues, because for a man that's lived his life so publicly, I feel like we haven't really seen a lot of his upbringing a lot lately anyway.
Sure.
It was a big deal back in the 80s.
He was a star
Playboy
for forever.
Town.
I mean, it's
right.
all that now, yeah.
Right. So whether that's a symptom of his overexposure or the 24/7 political news cycle, I'm not sure, but it's a very unique look at the guy that would be president and is our leader now, and I highly recommend it if you have any interest in politics or the man himself. Definitely worth checking out. Whichever way you lean, I think you can find some things to get mad about and some things to appreciate from it.
Yeah, I'm curious to watch that. I'm going to have to do
it's
it.
It's a good one.
Almost did it. I did binge Wild Wild Country.
You tweeted about this.
This documentary is obsession worthy. It's also infuriating at times. Infuriating. And it touches nerves.
I was going to say,
me personally,
your hair is a tinge grayer today.
Look, I was hooked from the trailer, just starting from the trailer, but it's a boring first episode. It's like an exposition dump. They get into the anti-religion in the first episode, and that whole sect moves to Oregon, and then it kind of they kind of paint both sides, and then it's conflict time. Once shit hits the fan, this story was mesmerizing.
And this is a documentary, you said.
I ripped off 5 episodes in one night. I almost started at like 5. I actually started at like 5:36, and I was done by like midnight, almost 1 o'clock. I couldn't stop.
How much laundry did you get done?
Laundry. Lots of laundry. But spellbinding. For me, this is like what Netflix does best. You know, they making a murderer just sucked you in, kept you going. Like, when they do a documentary series like this and just allow their people to blow it up and
the
really
keepers, yeah.
do the deep dive and make it as entertaining
Keep
as they can.
Keep hitting that play button for sure.
Making it episodic. Oh, yeah. I was all about it. But it's a nerve toucher.
I'm with you. It's definitely something. I've not checked it out yet. I plan on doing it soon, especially with that high glowing recommendation. So that's it for that's all we have for the Netflix TV shows. If you want to check some of those out, maybe still steer clear of a couple of them. Like we said, we just wanted to highlight those. But what we do here is movies. Again, our first Netflix in review covered the year of 2017, but it did come out in mid-late November of last year. So we wanted to just touch base on the 2017 films that came out after that episode was taped. So Mike's going to give you a couple insights to those movies that came out late 2017.
Icarus won the best documentary feature.
Surprising,
at the Oscars.
I think, too.
So we forgot to review this on that pod.
Whoops!
That first pod. And we actually seen it before it, but unfortunately we forgot to review it. So, I mean, listen, I thought it was timely and well told. I thought the story weaves into something you'd never expect. A lot of breakneck turns in it, which is interesting. I don't think Icarus is on the level with Last Man in Aleppo, Faces Places, or Jane, for that matter, which I saw on Hulu lately. So I know we're trying to plug Netflix stuff here. It's good. It's worth a watch. I think if you're totally into cycling, if you're totally into the Olympics and all those stories and you're staying current with it, it's fascinating. And there's an unlikely character that really shines, which is fun to take that turn with. But
yeah, and I can't tell if it's because the country is so Russia obsessed right now, if that had to do with its Oscar win or exactly what the deal was. It's entertaining. It keeps your attention for sure. It's no OJ Made in America. It's probably no Andre.
Maybe
the
a weaker year for documentaries, but
I don't know
there
that it's
is.
Even the square. But yeah,
speaking of documentaries that came out kind of the end of 2017, One of Us is going to be a documentary version of Obedience coming out with Rachel Weisz and Rachel McAdams about the Hasidic Jewish community and some pros and cons with that, let's say.
Yes.
Moving on.
Yes.
There's also Kingdom of Us, which is a very sad documentary about a family at the death of their father. So it's a really well done documentary. It's very personal. It's emotional. On Body of Soul might be the most Oscar-y movie in the history of best foreign films.
Really?
It is the artsiest, most extra fartsiest movie that's ever been nominated. It's okay. It's good. It's well made. It's super trippy and weird, but it's sound. I saw The Traitor, which was a short film about a Polish traitor in very
I thought it was about an architect.
Rural, very rural Poland, and it's basically what you think it is. It's an interesting 20, 30 minutes, whatever it is.
So it's a Polish traitor documentary about a Polish traitor.
But it's very sad. The potatoes are involved.
Okay, all right. Pierogies?
Maybe
a little kielbasa?
They don't have enough. Borscht? I don't think they have enough resources to make pierogies.
Oh,
it's very
God.
Sad.
That,
no,
that is a tragedy.
It's a tragedy. Bright was not as bad as I feared with Will Smith.
Let me tell you something about Will Smith. Here's his problem now. Will Smith has gotten to the point in Hollywood where when he was on the come up, there's all these articles, Grantland had it back in the day, that Will Smith would research these roles. And he'd research what was doing well at the box office, and he knew Alien movies were big, he knew detective movies were big, so when the Alien detective movie of Men in Black, he really put himself out there for it, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
Will Smith has gotten so powerful that he can make his own roles now. I don't know that he has the touch to kind of decide on his own what's going to work.
Game of Thrones meets cop thriller?
Yeah. Yeah.
Touching all the big race buttons.
Pitch that again.
Buttons.
Yeah. You're telling me the orcs have subtext behind them?
This movie, this story doesn't work. Let's be totally honest with you. However, the Joel Edgerton is awesome in it. I thought he emotes through all that makeup. And some of the action is kick-ass. Like, there are some great sequences. So I'm with it to an extent. I mean, it kind of falls a little bit for you. But it tries to be like Lethal Weapon meets Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, not the greatest premise, though it was kind of unfairly critical. I mean, it is what it is. It's just, it's a movie that with glaring subtext that's almost not even subtext anymore.
Bit on the nose, yes.
You think?
The high as a kite level premise that doesn't, that doesn't pay off. I will say, Mindhorn, the weirdest watch. I avoided it forever. It's about this British, washed up British actor from, he was a hit on a TV show in the 70s and 60s maybe, like this spy show, this like nonsense James Bond. There's a murder or a murderer or a serial killer who is telling the cops he wants to speak to the old character from the TV show because he's delusional and thinks it's real. So they have to get this actor out of pseudo retirement. He's doing these bogus TV commercials, and he thinks it's like his big break to get back on the scene. I laughed hard a few times during this movie, Mindhorn, this ridiculous thing, and it packs a few great laughs to it, so I do recommend that one. So those are my 2017 carryovers.
Yeah, those are the ones that we didn't get a chance to get to that came out after we had taped the 2017 year in review, so let's get to the current stuff. These are going to be the movies going forward. On Netflix right now, on the streaming service, available to you for you to watch at your leisure, and we're going to go through them, probably 30 of them-ish, maybe a little more, to tell you what is worth your time and what is not. Also, Mike's going to lead us off with the Jack Black movie, The Polka King. I think it was about my grandfather.
Yeah, Jenny Slate, Jackie Weaver, Jason Schwartzman, J.B. Smoove, a lot of J's. Listen, this movie's kind of silly with the music spectacles of the first scene all the way to the serious documentary type of level premise there. And the documentary is really good. I watched that as well. It's really strong. So as a companion piece, both of those works. The dilemmas posed to his character are serious, and it's kind of a tonal juggling act.
We're in a bit of a Jack Black comeback too. We got Jumanji, this. He won't get far on foot. He's having to make his rounds.
I'm a fan. I just am. I think he does a terrific job.
I am more willing to accept him now than I was in the King Kong reboot from Peter Jackson days.
I don't want him to be an A-lister, but I'm thoroughly happy with him being a C-lister. And he's hamming it up. I'm a sucker for it. So go do the deep dive. It's worth it. I thought also a strong writing job by Maya Forbes and Wallace Wolodarski. I wanted to mention them because they really have to juggle.
Strong Polish name there.
They have to juggle some tones here, man. It's not easy. So you did a futile and stupid gesture.
So I think this might be one of my favorite movies now.
Cool.
I am in love with it. I didn't expect it. I had problems with the way that the wife character was portrayed early in the movie. She was just kind of there as a plot device. They dealt with the way they treated women through the narrative aspect that the movie was presented in. It was Martin Mull is kind of the conscience of the movie, the older version of the main character.
It comes to a head. I mean,
it's about the National Lampoon, which if you don't know is the comedic. It started as a magazine, but it curtailed into the making of Caddyshack and Animal House and all these beloved properties. It was basically Doug Kenny, was the main character that was based on. Will Forte plays him. It was basically the set for what SNL would come to be from.
Lorne Michaels stole all those
took
characters.
Took all the comedians, yeah.
John Belushi, Chevy Chase, Gilda Radner.
Yeah, all of them, yeah.
Aykroyd.
Bill Murray. There was Neil Casey is in this, who's a voice actor. He's in so many things. He had so many dry one-liners that put me into hysterics. I love the emotional narratives.
David Wayne's the king of the aside, isn't he?
Oh, man. It was so good. I loved it. I know I'm going to have it higher than a lot of people do. I felt I related to a couple of things of it. It was interesting to watch guys like Joel McHale play Chevy Chase throughout this movie, knowing that they worked together
funny.
In Community. Yeah. And they pulled it off pretty well.
He doesn't look like Chevy
Not
Chase,
at all,
but he got the voice right. He wears a ridiculous wig
throughout the whole thing too, but it's a fun watch for sure. I think even if you have no investment in it, it's a good way to kill an hour and 40 minutes. So I cannot recommend this enough. Especially it sent me down the Neil Casey rabbit hole on YouTube afterwards, which I was laughing my ass off. I think he's one of the funniest guys out there. Highly, highly recommend it. And if you watch it and you don't like it, screw you.
Drunk, Stoned, Brilliant, Dead is the documentary accompanying that. So if you can, another one from Netflix that you can watch two movies for the price of one.
So let's go from the highest of highs. So, Mike, you had Mute.
I think I could drum up the most rage over this film than anything else in the slate today, because I did have high hopes for this. This was supposed to be Duncan Jones, son of David Bowie, director of Source Code and Moon.
Yep, big
He's
ones.
Done some good stuff. This was supposed to be his passion project that was brewing for a long time, but this movie commits some unforgivable sins. Number one, you have a Blade Runner-like fantasy futuristic world here. This setting is amazing looking, and you showcase some of it. You get the flying cars, you get the cool look of it.
Yes,
you got all these little touches, like the drones giving you food and all the weird fast food joints and a lot with food, and you have all those trimmings, and then the finale of the film takes place in a basement. What WTF are they doing? What are they doing?
Juxtaposition.
Terrible. Okay. So that's unforgivable sin, cardinal sin would be a better word for it.
Sure.
Cardinal sin number one. Now, cardinal sin number two, easily the most likable character in the film, becomes a big bad by the end of it, becomes a villain. I mean, that's a little bit of a spoiler, but I hope nobody says it. WTF, that's dirty pool, as this guy would say, yes, across from me now. Number three, a lot of the sex stuff is gross, and that is not just...
There's a look into our psyches.
That's not just my puritanical upbringing there.
Sex is gross.
No, it's because it's with robots, so it's gross. Robot sex, cardinal sin number three.
Does that make you a racist?
Against robots.
Yes.
Perhaps. Number four, I don't like the hero. And that's the biggest problem.
Well, that's
like
a this, big sin, yes.
I don't care if he wins. I'm kind of rooting for the other character until the movie doesn't allow me to root for the other character any longer.
I could see that being a huge problem, yes. The protagonist being unlikable.
So you can read between the lines here, but I thought it was the best mustache in any film in a long, long time. So go Paul Rudd for that. So I'm finding a silver lining, but this is a hateable movie.
Yeah, it's unfortunate, too, because it did come with a lot of hype and a lot of hope on our end. Loaded cast. We love Skarsgård. We love Paul Rudd. Skarsgård just coming off the Big Little Lies performance that he won the Golden
Globe
for.
He's going for it in this movie, too.
Yeah, it's just a shame. It sucks.
Work. Mike, going to give us a call back to the Cloverfield paradox.
So there's nothing I can really add to this that we didn't cover in our episode number 37. We covered this in full over an hour talking about the Cloverfield paradox.
Basically calling us back to that episode. Go listen to that episode.
We are company men. It's more... It's going to be remembered more for its marketing technique than I think anything to do with the movie itself, save for maybe the walking hand scene, the cousin it scene, or the cousin. What's the name of the hand in Adam's Family? Was it cousin it?
I don't remember.
You're a bad person.
I've seen Adam's Family. I've seen the first two movies.
Thing,
I never watched
whatever it is. I don't remember
Adam's Family Values.
I'm just as bad as you. But Cloverfield Paradox, look, if you're into absurd sci-fi, if you like mind-bending things, sure, check it out. You can live your life without seeing it. 10 Cloverfield Lane and the Cloverfield, the original movie. Far more rewatchability than this one, which, as a matter of fact, when it was made, was not even made as a Cloverfield movie.
Would you see yourself rewatching this, Mike?
Maybe in a world where they take a couple years off and somebody, either J.J. Abrams himself or somebody very close to him, takes the helm for the franchise. If I wanted to binge them all and get the narrative structure down, if there is one, sure. But
if the next movie's called the Cloverfield Amalgamation and they double down on the same
the Cloverfield TI-83 calculator. Yeah, no, I don't think so.
Maybe then you'd read it. No, okay.
You had seen All Red, another documentary. You had a big documentary plate full for you.
I had
for
a
you.
Kick there going. Yeah. A fascinating doc about a demonized figure by both sides, and that's very clear in the documentary.
She is a lawyer.
I'm not familiar with her story, so this was kind of necessary for me. I'm wondering if it's a bit biased. I don't know. She comes off looking pretty good at the end of it. And
the subject of her own documentary looks like a decent person in the documentary?
Correct. So she comes off as a feminist hero
right
at the end of this documentary.
This isn't to say that Gloria Allred hasn't done good things. She has certainly done a lot of good things, but she is always in front of a camera when she has a client.
Well, I tell you what. So me just watching the documentary, I'm all for her. Again, I don't know the real story. So take that for what you will. I guess... Going on the opposite side of the spectrum here, I also did The Open House kind of around the same time period. That's why
not a documentary, isn't it?
Not a documentary. Ugh. Easily the worst film of the year so far.
Wow.
So dumb, so unnecessary.
This is your Death Note of 2018.
Over the top, gross, aggravating, delivers no goods. I can't even get hyped up at this, but I'm basically going to quote the end of Billy Madison and say, at no point were you even close to anything resembling a rational thought.
The Open House, Amityville Horror with Ryan Reynolds, or The Crazies with Timothy Oliphant?
I love The Crazy.
So did I. It was great.
Loved it. So I'm buying that all day. I'm seeing Amityville Horror.
And this
Ryan
gets
Reynolds
the short
style.
End, huh?
Oh, I'm skipping this all day. Please skip it. If you listen to anything from this podcast, skip The Open House. Mike, you did The Ritual.
Which was a decent horror movie. I mean, it has its faults. It's not perfect by any means, but it does do its job in keeping you on the edge of this seat. The Ritual, if you don't know, is five friends who want to do something fun on vacation. They can't agree on a place. So being in their late 30s, early 40s, kind of a midlife crisis type thing. Don't freak out on
me.
They
do a hiking vacation, huh?
Yes, they decide to hike through the Alps, or not the Alps, but the Swiss mountain range.
Right.
And it takes a turn because one of their friends, they watch, this isn't a spoiler, it happens very early in the movie, they watch one of their friends get murdered, essentially, in front of them. One of the party does. So they take
kinda
a hike
haunts
for him.
Them. Yeah, it kind of haunts them.
A little bit. A little bit. You'll be pleased to know that taking a shortcut in a horror movie still goes as well today in 2018 as it did back
That's
in like
true.
99's Blair Witch Project. Great quote from the movie.
If the conventions are alive and well, yes.
If a shortcut was a shortcut, it wouldn't be called a shortcut. It would be called a route. I thought that was funny as a one-liner.
Oh, yeah, good
before
line.
All the,
good line. Good
the anger happens. It's a fun horror movie. Very suspenseful. I thought it had a shit ending. It's almost the exact opposite feeling I had going through A Futile and Stupid Gesture, which, you know, started low for me, ended up beloved. This one kind of had a high start for me because I'm a big horror movie aficionado and it was hitting a lot of the right notes. But like you said, it hits a lot of the same repeated tropes and gets a little out of its way at the end. So
I'm on the record for this one. But I mean, you can listen to other pods, but I'm glad you found some redeeming quality out of it. I mean it was kind of like, it was probably my third movie of the day or something like that,
and not the best horror movie we're going to review
on
this
episode. I was
aggravated
with it when I watched it.
You had Paradox.
These actors really can't act, and it's not their fault. They're musicians. So this is a Neil Young music movie where it's they do like big interludes of Neil Young songs and new Neil Young songs, and there's music montages and there's all this wild stuff, and it's like an hour-long music video, except they cut in like short films with all these musicians trying to act. Now, I'm very happy Daryl Hannah gets a chance to cut her teeth as a writer-director. So that's Netflix developing talent. But there's a couple cardinal sins. These non-actors, she doesn't helm them the right way, and it's bad. And it's cringeworthy, really cringeworthy. Music is good, so I'm trying to give some positives and silver linings. But the story is also kind of nonsense. Nonsense is sometimes good, but stop! I don't care if it's a nonsense. That was my setup, because... Stop titling movies Paradox. Stop it. Every movie, it's like saying the movie is called Conflict. The movie is called Exposition. Stop saying Paradox, because every movie should have a paradoxical conflict at the center of it. Every story.
So we learned that your limit for those such things are two. With Cloverfield in this one.
There's a lot of paradox. I'm going to IMDb it right now. There's going to be a lot of paradox. Type, type, to type, type, type. Here we go. Oh, my God. 84 titles. 84, Mike. You got mad about horses. I'm getting mad about the word paradox.
I was just
84 titles on IMDb.
I was going to say the movie called The Horse Paradox may have the universe sink in on itself on this podcast.
Mike. Weird transitions right now. Game over, man.
Yeah, the Workaholics boys are back because they were gone for so long. I think all about, 6 months maybe? Their room service trio this time, who long for more, like many down on their luckers, are convinced they have the next big idea, which just needed a chance and some funding. And lucky for them, the hotel they work for is hosting the big party for one of the hottest influencers.
YouTubers, that was kind of funny.
Bay. The security detail has mind of its own in this one. It turns into an exploitation track where they are the three unwitting heroes who are recently fired from the hotel chain, have to save everyone in the hotel.
From a stick-up, from a big hostage
situation.
So it's Die Hard with the Workaholics guys.
Right. It's an action comedy, but in true Workaholic style, it has us seeing way more of like...
Wieners.
Everything. Than we've ever needed to. We got Salvia abuse, arguably the best Shaggy concert of all time, the single most absurd shootout in movie history,
yes,
and more close-ups of Adam Devine's penis than you'd ever need. Cameos by King Bach, Joel McHale, Donald Faison, a certain Shark Tank alum, are icing on top of the comedic cake. There's a lot simpler,
I
easy
love
way.
The cameos in this movie.
Oh, they are. King Bach, by the way, also in The Way We Met or How We Met, which I'll get to later on in the episode, friends with a lot of things. He's friends with Lamorne Morris from New Girl. He's friends with the Workaholic guys. The guy made his name for himself on Vine, but he's becoming an established Hollywood talent, so I'm excited about that. There's a lot shorter way to say this review. If you like Workaholics,
right.
You'll kill 100 minutes successfully and happily with this movie.
Few good laughs.
Yeah, definitely, for sure. It's worthwhile. You had Ladies First.
Worthwhile 40 minutes. This is a short film. This is a foreign film. But listen, I have a new rooting interest at the Olympics now. This is about the archer from India, Deepika Kumari. She, born in India. Not a lot of female athletes coming from developing nations these days.
That's for sure.
This is an important story about this girl overcoming a lot of stereotypes, overcoming a culture that's not accepting of female athletes. And it's an underdog story, but it also is kind of like a little sports fleece going on. Tokyo 2020, I'm rooting for her. And,
cool. It is important to show those kinds of stories, especially about the suppressed and depressed. They deserve their own pedestal.
Yes, again, no sense, rhyme, or reason to this order. The other movie I'm going to talk about is The Outsider. This is Jared Leto's Yakuza.
You're not going to hear me say one negative thing about this. I have too much respect for the man.
This character assassinates himself mid-movie. So you're kind of along with him for a while. He kind of does some good things or whatever, some anti-hero things. Mm-hmm. And then he goes too far in the middle of the movie before at the end of the movie he's supposed to be the hero again. I'm sorry. I can't buy it. This movie's also gross and non-suspenseful. I'm kind of half paying attention.
What do you mean by gross?
It's gross because there's all the harakiri and there's samurai swords and slicing
body
and body violence. Okay. And it's gross and it doesn't really thrill you with it. It's just like...
Well, it's Jared Leto, so it's the greatest movie on Netflix
Japanese
this year.
Japanese gangster movies.
And Walk on Water was a banger.
Now, I said in the See by Skip episode that I would rather commit harakiri myself before watching this movie again.
You did.
And I stick to that because I have serious hype against this movie. I'm sorry. I don't care how much you like Jared Leto. I hated it.
Go put the movie on. Support Jared Leto. No. Walk on Water is a banger.
When we first met, another Adam Devine movie.
Yeah,
Mike
so
has
the
a
problem.
Niche to this episode.
Here's the problem, right? We saw Adam Devine in a Netflix movie with great chemistry with his co-stars. It's just that he's had great chemistry with the guys that he's known for years and years and years.
Yes.
And then he has to have chemistry with Alexandra Daddario, one of the most beautiful women on the planet. And he's Adam Devine. No disrespect to him. He's better looking than I am. But it didn't work for me. It's a cutesy story. I hate to sound like I'm so down about it. It's if you could watch it for, you know, a Sunday hangover day and you need to kill some time.
Mildly amusing.
Yeah, it's fine. It's a couple chuckles. It's got a funny story. To give you a premise, Divine this time is Noah. He's a love-struck best friend of Alexander Daddario's Avery. Since they're meet-cute in college at a college Halloween party, it turns into a crossover between The Butterfly Effect and Click, Adam Sandler's Click. And this time the big... time traveling / universe altering thing.
What a high concept duo premise that is. It's a great job.
It's an old timey photo booth that they keep going back. There is some high notes of this. Shelley Henning was not someone I was familiar with. She plays Avery's best friend, Carrie. I thought she was very, very good.
Yeah, I liked her in it.
I tend to lean somewhere between the IMDb 6.4 and Metacritic's 35.
It wasn't terrible.
No, it's fine. And you had the hip hop classic, Roxanne.
Yeah, the music takes a backseat in this movie, and that's not a bad thing. I was expecting more of a musical biopic with all the trimmings and conventions thereof, but this is more of a character study about Roxanne Shanté, played by Shanté Adams, who's terrific in the main role here, very versatile, plays her young, plays her older. Mahershala Ali is in this, and he's
love
great.
Him.
Yeah, I mean, he's great and everything. But this
True
is
Detective
more,
Season 3.
Yeah, this is more of a family drama. But it still works.
So the Roxanne and her, that performer's influence on the whole hip-hop gang, if you know anything about the history of hip-hop, she was like the first female at the forefront of it all, and coming from, I think it was Brooklyn in New York, definitely Manhattan. Beef, actually, the Beef documentary series.
Oh, yeah.
Goes into her stellarly. I think it's really entertaining to watch. So
I'm going to have to watch that because I didn't get my fix necessarily. But those are some of the highlights of the movie when it gets into her musical life and kind of the arc of her career there. But I'm thrilled to see Michael Larnell get the Netflix platform. This is only his second feature film as a director, as a writer. So to me, again, Netflix developing talent. Mike, you did Darren Brown, The Push.
Yeah, this is like the worst version of ABC's What Would You Do? Right? It's a social experiment. It puts unwitting participants into these social situations, only instead of stepping in when somebody's being racist or stepping in when a parent is scolding a child too much, it's can you be coerced enough to commit murder?
My God.
And it goes through, it's this elaborate setup, it's this elaborate prank. Darren Brown himself describes it as a genuine experiment into general compliance. Can we be manipulated through the familiar forces of social pressures to commit murder?
Yes.
It sounds absurd. It sounds absurd, but it is a thrilling watch. I was on the edge of my seat. The twist at the end is unbelievable.
Yes.
It's definitely worthwhile. Definitely recommend.
So I'm kind of giddy just hearing you talk about it. Yeah, it's a wild watch. So I'm totally with you. I did First Match.
Yes.
This is about a female wrestler in high school. I thought it was a solid sports movie, but it's another one that really kind of takes a deep dive into a family drama, a cultural drama about the time and place, and how kids can get used and abused indirectly or directly by their parents, by neglect, by the system, by the foster system in this case. So there's also a flip side of that coin, because it's still a sports movie. It's also about the positivity of sports and how that can, you know, be a great influence on their life, and yet injuries and the flip side. Did I do a flip side already?
So you're flipping. You're flipping a lot of sides.
There's multi-dimensions.
Yeah.
There's three dimensions.
You're saying it's not a 2D. It's like a 3 or 4D.
It's a 3D movie. Yeah. I mean, there's dimensions, but there's also about a part of this that's about the dangers of sport and illegal sport. So I thought it was really solid storytelling, an impressive debut, directorial debut by Olivia Newman here. Her filmmaking prowess is easy to see. She's going to be involved with movies, hopefully Netflix movies and silver screen movies in the future. She also writes a great script. There's a lot of depth. The subplots all build into the main one. I'm looking at it from a screenwriting perspective, I thought she did a terrific job.
Glowing recommendation from you. It's funny because the next movie I had was Take Your Pills, and it kind of ties into that hyper-competitive landscape America's youth has. And
I had one good transition involved in this. Otherwise, just throwing shit at the wall.
It's by Allison Clayman. It's the history of the rise of the amphetamines and other stimulants use in American culture is examined. We are shown the evolving nature of drug use in society over time, from widely used miracle drug to heavily stigmatized evil, back to study aid that everybody uses. It goes through Adderall, different kinds of stimulants and uppers that Ritalin.
Yep.
And I am concerned with how positively the drugs are shown in this documentary, because look, the first 50 minutes, there's no evil attached to any of this. And you think, okay, when the tone of the documentary turns, now we're going to get head on into all the bad stuff that comes and how these kids' lives were ruined and blah, blah, blah. The only person that really expresses his life being ruined due to overuse of Adderall is a former NFL offensive tackle named Evan Britton, who was a second round pick of the Jaguars, who said, yeah, it got me dehydrated on the field, basically.
Right.
And it's like, okay, so your main subject to talk about how bad these things are, the con side of this, is a guy, an elite athlete, performing on a stage that maybe 0.0001% of the population has to ever worry about performing on. It was weird in that aspect for me. I think the information is good. I think Allison Clayman did a commendable job with the documentary overall. I don't know. Maybe I'm being too biased here.
But the movie may have a bias, though, too.
It could. I don't know if the subjects do. It certainly interviews a lot of the older people and a lot of the young students that use and abuse these drugs. I don't know. It's interesting. I think it's one of those things you kind of have to watch and see for yourself.
The history lesson of it, you don't think they gave enough of the effects of that? Like, they didn't have that study at their fingertips?
Look, every...
Because there's got to be.
Every
like,
drug
people
documentary, you have these people that say, you know, it ruined my life, this happened and that happened.
Well, but people have been on amphetamines for 60, 70 years, back from World War II.
Right, but and Adderall specifically is the one kind of hammered home the most throughout this. And it's been around for at least 2 decades now, I would think. It's just not... There's nothing there that says, I took too much Adderall and I couldn't get shit done. You get away, you walk away from it saying, man, Adderall might be a miracle drug that dehydrates you.
What? Yeah, that's
right.
It doesn't give you the effects
necessarily.
Exactly.
I needed more dark side. Okay. But that said, the information provided, I do recommend it as a watch. And watch it and tell me if I'm totally wrong, too. Maybe I missed something. You had the Titan, though.
Terrible. Tom Wilkinson, what are you doing? I mean, we've touted Tom Wilkinson,
so
who played Ben Franklin and John Adams. He was a crazy lawyer in Michael Clayton. He had a Michael Stuhlbarg era to his career where he was just the character actor in all our favorite 2000s movies, you know, in that first decade, that millennial
decade. Was supposed to take the torch from him,
We were loving his work. And then, I don't know, what is he doing this for? This is the star of Avatar is in this movie. I'm not even going to remember his name. I don't care. Because I'm so mad at him because he's doing such a shitty job with his career. This movie sucked. I barely paid attention to it. Moving on. Happy anniversary, Mike.
Maybe they just, like, they were sitting across the table in the negotiation, and they just had to keep adding a zero every time you threw the paper back for the price. I don't know.
Had to be, because I want to transition already. Happy anniversary, Mike.
Happy anniversary was cute. It was really fucking cute.
It was kind
of cute. Noelle Wells and Ben Schwartz play Molly and Sam, a couple coming to the grips with the realities of unhappiness, life, and what exactly it means to be in love during a long-term relationship in their 30s on the day of their third anniversary. It's a cute look through the trial and tribulations of a real, emphasis added, relationship. It takes away from the nice guy stalkery vibe that I have a problem with a lot of rom-coms, and it presents an actual relationship and the highs and lows of it. And the director, Jared Stern, who was a writer on the Lego Batman movie, does a wonderful job weaving together flashbacks.
Oh, now I'm starting to connect some dots.
Well, I'm a Ben Schwartz fan, first and foremost, so yes, I am biased there. But
he's funny.
Weaving together flashbacks with present-day timeline, and he's able to encapsulate the sweet and tender emotional moments with those stupid, asinine fights all of us have had with a significant other where we say something we can't take back. Watch it. It's cute.
If you're trying to impress a SO, a significant other,
a lady friend or a man friend, watch it. You'll get points. You had Benji, which a movie I will not watch. I refuse to watch.
Mike, I was shaking during this movie. I was such an emotional wreck the entire
film. I cried during the ASPCA commercials, man.
And yes, Mike, I can't.
Leaving that in. This is the most we've struggled with emotion in any movie so far.
Tore my heart.
Yeah, of course it did.
Asunder. I am rooting for this dog like he is my own family member. I am just.
And you dare question my love for Okja.
I was shaking watching this movie. And here's the thing: Blumhouse made this movie.
Of course they did, because Blumhouse runs everything. They know it. They get it.
Well, here's the thing: like, Blumhouse is getting into the how do we make big money off a small budget game.
Yep.
And not it worked in horror
Killer
movies.
Killer clowns and small golden retrievers.
Think about kids' movies typically do that, right? So how can we make big money off a small budget? Well, every kid in America will buy it, right? Every kid in America will see it. Every kid in America will buy it on home video or whatever, watch it on Netflix. Netflix will pay big for sequels. So they're getting in on that game, and they make a good movie, but they also got a little edge to the drama in this, because the drama is some serious shit. I mean, Benji is going against some serious criminals.
I don't want to hear about it.
Oh, my God.
I don't want to hear about it.
But it's so adorable, and it pays off, and I will tell you all, spoilers included here, it's a happy ending.
Oh, thank God.
The kids movie Benji.
Maybe
yes.
I'll watch the first 20 minutes and the last five then.
But it's nerve-wracking.
I can't watch a dog go through any pain and suffering. I can't do it.
Speaking of nerve-wracking, Irreplaceable You.
Yes.
Some nerves were racked. Gugu Mbatha-Raw, the star of Cloverfield Paradox.
She was good in it. She was good in Cloverfield Paradox.
Good again here. Michelle Huisman from Game of Thrones. Steve Coogan, Veep's Timothy Simons. Jackie Weaver from Silver Linings Playbook. SNL's Kate McKinnon. Oh, big names. And of course,
it is a loaded cast.
One more big name, Christopher Walken. Being funny again, Christopher Walken. So I'm not against this movie. Yes, it's sappy and overtly sad. It's trying to play a violin and get your heartstrings. But it's also like weaving a very tricky plot. It almost goes to rom-com territory, pulls back, and then actually, I don't know, it wasn't as terrible as I thought. The critics freaking turned on this movie. Like, ooh, this is a movie about cancer and death and very serious subject matter, and they turned on it just the same. They're like, no, cancer is not like that, death is not like that, you're not allowed to say that, no, you're wrong. How dare you have a personal experience? Every critic got very angry at this. I thought it was a heartfelt storyline. No, it's not a great movie, but it's not like a 20% on Rotten Tomatoes. So it was better than I thought. I really liked the performances in the cast. Mike, you did Stepsisters?
Listen to me.
Oh, no.
I don't want to ever hear you say I don't do things for you, okay? Existence is Pain.
This was one of the movies that I listed that I did not watch, and Mike took one for the team here.
I'd rather watch a marathon of Dirty Money than Stepsisters. It's exactly what you think it is. It's not good. There was a positive. The lead, Meghalyn Etchikan-Woke, was pretty good. It's tough. It's based on this sorority of step dancing, and they have to help kids, and there's other sorority and college things going on, but these people playing these college students are so very obviously older than college aged. That's rough.
Oh, really? In a tween comedy?
Yeah, that's rough. It's not good.
Okay.
I'm excited to see Megalyn Etrick and Woke and other things. Oh, okay. He was very good.
Some
but
potential.
I don't have to watch Stepsisters. No, I wish I never did.
Wow. You're a man amongst men.
End us on Ravenous, please.
Zombie movie that delivers the goods. Fast Zombies, which is kind of cool. I haven't seen a fast zombie movie in a while. I like 28
Days Later, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's a Quebec zombie movie. They kind of pull off the weird tone that it kind of strikes for a while. They're telling jokes throughout the movie. So it kind of works for me because it's like a David Lynch, Hal Hartley kind of thing going on there. It's not to that level or execution. There's also some weird, I like a weird almost zombie art film. I appreciated this movie at the time I watched it. It's probably not great, but something that you can appreciate. Well, art film.
Let's talk about another subtitled horror movie that might be great. It's one of the two big ones we're doing. We're going to, again, present you two pretty much full in-depth looks at different movies that are on Netflix currently that might be up for Oscar consideration in a couple categories. We're going to give you full deep dives into them right now. The first one will be Veronica, which is a Spanish horror movie about basically Ouija board and demon possession, that fun stuff. This will be a spoiler-free review. We will go into the plot of Veronica. We'll approach it probably like we do an Oscar Sprint profile in that just kind of way.
Quicker, we think, we hope, we maybe.
Yeah, we're hoping. So do we have a production profile, Michael?
Quickly, cast and crew. This movie is co-written and directed by Paco Plaza. Records 1, 2, and 3. All were pretty good zombie horror films,
yeah,
found footage
fun
movies. Record 1 was made into an English version, Quarantine, starring the girl from Dexter. Wasn't terrible either.
Jennifer Carpenter, yeah.
I think I like the first and third records the best. The third movie is about zombie apocalypse at a wedding, which is kind of terrific. So, listen, the co-writer is Fernando Navarro from Toro and Spy Time. Mutant Cross the Line are his next two writing projects. So this is a well-written movie. Sandra Escanseña, she makes her feature film debut. She's 17 years old, 18 years old. Does a nice job as
well,
I think.
She was very, very good. I mean, it's tough always when you're making your debut, you're that young, and you have to carry a movie, but she had to play terrified, and she was terrified.
And she's got some versatility there because she's interacting with the kids.
Yeah, for sure.
Her little brother and two sisters. So Veronica also stars Bruno Gonzalez, Claudia Placer, Ivan Chavero, Anna Torrent, and Consuelo Trujillo. A couple of those are the very young actors. They really picked some talented kids to act in this movie.
I was surprised. I was expecting one to be kind of a weak link, as is usually the case, especially in relatively low-budget movies like this. But no, these kids carried their weight, and they killed it, I thought, as a total cast.
The film is loosely based on the 1991 Vallecas case, where Estefania Gutierrez Lazaro used a Ouija board, and strange things occurred from there. I mean, there's like an article or 10 on the internet. There's a YouTube video that's super creepy. I'll let all you folks read and watch that for spoilers, but to suffice it to say, allegedly, the police witnessed and recorded in their police reports some paranormal activity. So that part of the story is allegedly, according to these online articles and on Wikipedia and the YouTube videos, that part is allegedly true.
And without spoiling anything, at the end of this movie, you are shown actual police photographs of the scene where all the final act went down.
Right.
Which is kind of cool to see that compared to what they showed in the movie.
We got some context.
Pretty good job.
Yeah, so you got the specs, Mike.
Yeah, it was released February 26th on Netflix of this year, and 88% on Rotten Tomatoes. It's 7 out of 10 Kravitz critics score. Only a 44% audience score, 3 out of 5 on average there. That's a little curious to me. It's a 6.3 out of 10 on IMDb. I don't understand that low of a score because I think objectively it's an entertaining movie, if nothing else. Maybe people got freaked out. Maybe
people thought it was
going to
be scarier. Because on the internet, they say, this is the scariest movie ever.
Which I have a problem with because I feel like every decent horror movie that comes out now is the scariest movie ever. I can remember Cabin in the Woods was one of the scariest movies ever. I can remember Goodnight Mommy, which was another foreign horror film when that came out. Scariest movie of all time. You do a disservice collectively by putting that much attention and that much weight into these films. Why can't they just be good horror movies?
Yeah, a lot of solid movies in that list you just said. And Goodnight Mommy was the latest one.
And yeah, I don't understand the reason for it, but yeah, okay, it's a good movie. 44% audience score, I quarrel with. If you don't like the movie, that's fine.
It's like dashed expectations.
Yeah, I don't think you should put that kind of pressure on it. 6.3 out of 10 on IMDb. The Goyer winner for Best Sound, Spain Cinema Writers Circle Award for Best Editing. The plot, Veronica must care for her younger brother and two sisters. She does have three siblings, like a surrogate mom, since her real mother is tasked with having to work at a bar and her father has passed away. Bored of her situation and curious on the occult since her father's death, and she does go to a religious school, Veronica convinces her friends to join in a seance during a solar eclipse with a Ouija board. And
bad timing.
You're not going to believe this. Something goes wrong. Of course, she's haunted by evil spirits. From then on, the only person who believes her is a blind nun, much in the same vein as another horror movie with a blind nun playing the main character that I cannot remember the name of right now, because there's been about three of them, I think.
Sister Death, yeah. She's called in this one.
Very ominous. Why not just Sister Mary? Why do you have to canonize her for
that?
Well,
the kids call her Sister Death, yeah.
Can Veronica get away from the sinister forces she's released? Can she protect her brothers and sisters? That's the plot. That's the premise of this movie that we had going in. It's done against, like Mike said, the backdrop is the police are kind of investigating what happened. So we start the movie and we end the movie with a 911 terrorized phone call imploring the cops to show up to this house where weird shit is going on.
1990 pre-cell phones. I thought the production values of this film were extremely strong. I thought the music, yeah,
I
was
have
a little
that
on the
as
nose.
Well. The cinematography, extremely well done.
Top notch, man. I love how this movie is shot, camera angles. So Paco Plaza, he's the found footage guy from Record.
Yeah.
He's the found footage guy from that trilogy, and he's just whipping the camera around, these beautiful arcs. I mean,
great shots, too. The overhead shot when the girls are at the Ouija board. You could see the special effects even work for such a low budget in this movie. I think everything about the actual way this was presented as a film was very well done.
It's got some artsy shots to it.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, the editing, another strength. I thought that had hit a nice rhythm. Obviously, you got to work it towards some scares. Now, this is not a jump scare kind of movie for us.
No, this is an edge of your seat, creep you out.
Creep you out one.
Which I think is a credit to all foreign horror films. And it's something they have historically done better than American horror films. American horror films rely way too much on jump scares for jump scares' sake.
Yeah.
Kind of the way you just said that Jared Leto movie was expositionally gory for the sake of gore. You don't need that. You don't need to do that. If you could weave in creepiness into a good plot, that'll substantiate enough of scares for any horror movie.
Another thing I'll say about the narrative is I thought they weaved in a nice coming-of-age story. I mean, we're going to hit the themes a little bit here, but
there were highlights for sure. I mean, it wanted to be more than just another ghost, satanic, demonic possession thing.
I mean, I'm an older brother of five kids and four younger brothers, and I related to a lot of the stuff she's going through, taking care of her, you know, little siblings there. I thought that was really grounded, and her being a complex character really worked for me.
Now,
so,
I will say,
yeah,
the star of this movie, and much the same reason I will not and cannot watch Benji, I would die before I let a hair on Antonito's head be harmed.
He was great.
He is my boy.
He's a great,
I love him.
He's like Jerry Maguire level cute and charismatic too.
He in his comedic timing was,
yeah.
What is he, 3 years old? He's got that kind of timing. I don't know if it's all the director's doing, but he was great in this movie. But my God, was I rooting for him. And if anything hurt him, I was going to jump through my television. He is the star of this show.
Yeah, I thought all the kids did a terrific job. The mother, Anna Torrent, she's a really good actress in her own right. She's been in a lot of stuff. I should have given her a filmography for
she didn't get a lot of exposition in this either. She was just kind of the mother.
But she's important in the sense that everything goes wrong because it's a movie about bad parenting, I guess. Bad parenting equals Satan and the devil worship? I don't know.
Well, look how we turned out. No.
No.
That's
no.
A joke.
Your mom is great.
We love both our parents. They're great people.
So best worst scenes. We'll get right into it, Mike. What do you think?
Terrible.
Oh, okay. You're still going about the parents. I had my hosting part.
I'm going to start on worst scenes first. Okay. My best scene's pretty easily explained. It'll take 2 seconds. Worst scene for me, I love the Sister Death character.
Yeah.
I think she plays her role well, and she's a good narrative plot device to get the story moving. And she's necessary for the big final showdown.
Yeah.
Because you don't get there without her.
Sure.
I don't need her explaining. I don't need her explaining everything so frankly. I don't need the teacher nun in the lessons that these kids happen to be learning explaining so frankly what the movie, your actions have consequence. What class are we in?
Oh, by the way, here is this during an eclipse horror story
back from primitive. What class is this? Hey, she's talking about the moon and the stars, and there's a solar eclipse that's going to happen that all the kids are going to watch, and then she immediately goes into, you know...
This was human sacrifice 3,000 years ago,
former
kids.
Societies used to believe there was stories in the eclipse that they would give lives for
the
kill people.
The imagery in the next slide is going to come up later.
They're going from a star in a slide. They click the star, the slide in the projector, and the next scene is like a human beheading. It's like, what are we doing?
Some of the haunted house conventions, some of the horror movie conventions, they're just hit too
forced,
hard.
Forced and obvious,
My worst scenes when she ignores the dangers early on. I mean, she's portrayed as kind of a smart, capable kid,
which helps the plot. It makes it more believable.
So I love that. And then she ignores the torn Ouija board falling out of the closet like twice, three times. How many times?
And why? Listen, in a horror movie, why does that always happen?
Why does the
demonic possession always have to fall out? Why can't it be like the Ouija board falls off and like she finds a basket of puppies?
I wrote down, I know, this crap is in every haunted house movie, but it's still really stupid.
We're underselling it. Now, my best scene, the reason I saved it for last is because it takes 2 seconds. The third act is my best scene. The showdown is so good. What happens, I was on the edge of my fucking seat. I couldn't look at the screen. I was so freaked out a couple times.
You really care about the characters.
Yeah. I thought everything was almost perfectly done for a horror movie in that third act. And especially when you see, you know, the exorcism of Emily Rose. The Exorcist is tough to compare this to because it was so long ago. But all these exorcism and these demonic possession movies, this one was done just as well, certainly better than some of the modern ones, and just as well as any other, I would say.
Yeah, I love that third act, like you said. I like the sister death stuff. I thought it was creepy. It creeped me out.
I could do without her just happening to hang out in the basement every time.
Yeah, it's true. You're not wrong. You're not wrong. But it was a little, that mid-movie creep, you know, that's good. I love the sequence where she tries to fight back, and you're almost thrown into this, like, you know, how to fix this kind of, almost she's an amateur detective sequence.
Yes.
I really enjoyed that. I gave her a ton of agency. It showed her super capable. I love that. And then there's the biggest artsy shot of the movie is in the midst of that with all the other characters walking backwards. I mean, it's a little bit of a spoiler, but, and she's
that's
walking forward.
Yeah.
I mean, that's an aesthetic spoiler, I guess, but it really strong in terms of production values, like I said. So you got any final thoughts on this one, Mike?
I had a question about the ending of the movie, about the end of the plot. I can't get into it, obviously, because of spoilers. I think there's some kind of linear storytelling problems with how the movie ended. But other than that, I gave it an 88 B+, especially for a horror movie. I think it's way up there. I loved it. I know I'm a horror movie guy, and I tend to rank those highly, but just as a movie, it's a great watch, and it's a complete story. And like you said, you give a shit about these characters because the characters have agency, and they are capable.
So I rewatched this with somebody who didn't love it, but now, as peer pressure, I'm giving it to you because you love it.
You would commit
it.
The murder
I'm gonna
the
go,
push.
My original grade was a B+, 87. I'm going to go back to that. My first watch, I was hooked. I was scared shitless for these kids. I was rooting for them like crazy, and it did pay off. So I'm going to go back to a B+ instead of a B86. It's a B+, 87. Yeah, I like Veronica.
So we're going to get into one more movie. Before we do that, like we do on all our retrospectives, it's been a while since we did them, but you'll remember them from our Oscar category reviews. We're going to do a top five, Perfecting Perfection, our top five films right now, currently, that are on Netflix, available to watch. All right, so here we go. I'll lead us off with number five. My number five, Take Your Pills. Again, thought it could have used more on the dark side, but anytime you have an informational documentary that shows you the whole world of medical and pills and the history of it, I think it's important, especially in this day and age when the opioid crisis is as big of an issue, not only in the homes, but in the federal government at large, in the state government. I think it's very important. This one is chock full of information, chock full of insight and interviews. And if nothing else, you get perspectives, different perspectives about people that use these different drugs as performance enhancers, which they are referred to as many times throughout the film, and as kind of things that should be that should be stayed away from because they can be abused. I'll go with Take Your Pills as my number five. What'd you have?
Yeah, I came away with that one more puzzled than anything. So that's interesting that you'd say that. I guess I came almost numb after watching that documentary.
It's tough. It's a thinker. It makes you think.
Definitely. My number five is First Match. I love sports movies. I love coming of age stories. I just hit all those notes for me. No delivered all those goods. Sure. You're number four.
Happy anniversary, damn it. It was charming. It's cutesy. It's nice. You know, for all the garbage rom-coms that are out there.
It's different.
That's why I have it so highly ranked, because I've had to suffer through all those rom-coms and those romantic stories. It's something that if you want something more serious than a conventional rom-com, but less serious than a big coming-of-age drama, it's in that nice little niche. It's a quick, easy watch, like you said, over an hour and 10 minutes. Love a happy anniversary.
Number four is Benji. I wish it had an exclamation point.
It should be my number one. I can't do it.
It was very strong. It was a very strong kids movie. Yes, there's some nonsense to it, but it works.
My number one is the first 15 minutes of Benji. What'd you have for number three?
A Futile and Stupid Gesture.
How dare you?
I did like it, but I like these other two a little bit more, but you keep going, Mike.
I'll wait on my number three because I'm almost positive it's your number one. My number two and one... Veronica, we just talked about, and I Am a Futile and Stupid Gesture, number one.
You liked it.
Loved it. Go ahead.
My number two was Veronica.
Sure.
We sung its praises, and I thought so. It's a worthy movie. Production values are up there on the year for me thus far.
Making your number one?
Speaking of production values being leading the ship, I was dazzled by what Annihilation has done. We're going to get into that. Number one of these Netflix movies. Again, it's Netflix overseas. I did cheat and see this in the theater a couple times with my movie pass.
Yeah, so. It's not available on American Netflix yet, so it should be there once the time comes. But it was in theaters, and that's why we're cheating a little bit. But
the rest of the world can see it on Netflix right now.
We're going to do a non-spoiler review to start. Then we'll hit the spoiler dance music, something you guys haven't heard in a while until we get to the spoiler section.
Yeah, I miss our music.
For your Annihilation. Music. Go ahead, Mike.
Cast and crew real quick. Written and directed by Alex Garland, the writer-director of Ex Machina, the screenwriter of Dread, Never Let Me Go, Sunshine, and 28 Days Later, and a longtime novelist. He also wrote for The Shelves, not only The Silver Screen. He wrote the novel The Beach, the Leonardo DiCaprio movie. He wrote The Tesseract, which is another big hit in terms of novels go, as science fiction novels. And many others. He's writing the screenplay right now for the upcoming Halo movie. So he's going big.
Yeah, it's got a lot of pressure on it.
A lot of pressure. Listen, Annihilation stars Natalie Portman, who was nominated for Jackie and won Best Actress for Black Swan.
She's good.
She's Jane. Yeah, she's Jane Foster from the first two Thors, which we've been doing in the MCU reviews. She's also in Closer, Garden State, Cold Mountain, Mars Attacks, and she's brilliant as a child actress in Leon the Professional and Heat.
She came out a thespian, and she'll die a thespian.
Yeah, the miniseries We Are All Completely Beside Ourselves and three films are coming out this year for Natalie Portman. The Life and Death of John F. Donovan, Pale Blue Dot, and Vox Lux, they all come out in 2018.
Yes.
Annihilation also stars Poe Dameron, a.k.a. Oscar Isaac, from Inside Llewellyn Davis and Drive.
Or does it?
Thor Ragnarok's Tessa Thompson, Jane the Virgin's Gina Rodriguez.
Who cannot be in enough things for me. I love Gina Rodriguez.
Her star's on the rise, and we'll get into more on that in a few minutes. Doctor Strange's Benedict Wong is in the beginning. Tuva Novotny, she's terrific. Mm-hmm. As well, and the always great Jennifer Jason Leigh, who, for
my money, had the best performance in this movie.
We've seen her recently in Good Time, Twin Peaks, and The Hateful Eight. Couple production notes. Annihilation is based on the first book in Jeff Vandermeer's Southern Reach trilogy. The producers Scott Rudin and Eli Bush acquired it pretty early on. It reminded me of Call Me By Your Name when it was in the manuscript stages. They secured the film rights, and they hired Alex Garland. So Alex Garland only went into the screenwriting process with the first book. So he did not have this books two and three. There was some criticism of the castings, as Natalie Portman and Jennifer Jason Leigh in the third novel are recognized as being Asian and Native American descent. But again, Garland, who had no...
Wasn't privy to that fact.
Yeah, he had no ethnicity for those characters in the first novel. So that's what he said against the backlash. I guess people have given him a pass. But it's another movie that kind of whitewashed. I mean, other people could have figure that out maybe down the road. It's some bad press going into this release. Take it for what it is. Principal photography began in April 2016 in South Forest, Windsor, in the Windsor Great Park in England, with a few July shoots also taking place in North Norfolk. I watched on a YouTube video that they did this because they wanted to kind of reshape another environment as that Florida swamp land, Southern Reach, USA.
Big couple months for Florida swamp lands.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, Florida Project, Annihilation, doing well for itself.
Yeah, so
come visit Sunshine State.
They were able to take the English countryside or English swamplands, bogs. They call it something different. Moors? Is it moors down there?
Whatever it is, it's correct the way they say it.
The way they say it. So, yeah, it's a very cool setting. Mike, you have some movie specs?
Yeah, let's talk about specs for Annihilation. And it was released in theaters in North America February 23rd of this year and released on Netflix around the rest of the world on March 12th. So just a recent debut a couple weeks ago. That's why we're including it in this episode. Mm-hmm. Box office sits at $32 million domestically, which is a relatively high number for a movie that was of this ilk, I would think. A thinking man's movie.
Yeah.
According to Deadline.com, Netflix paid more than half of the film's $40 million budget, so I can't do math all that well, but I'm pretty sure that means the studio got their investment back if you count the North American box office, plus the Netflix payment, or it's at
that
least
kind of math
negligible.
Is way too above our pay grades, yes. I don't can't blame you there.
I've just multiplied things by 2.5 since we started doing this pod, and that's really the extent of my... Critics love this movie. It's got an 87% on Rotten Tomatoes with a 7.6 out of 10 average critic rating. Audiences are running with a 67% on Rotten Tomatoes with a 3.6 out of 5 average
score.
Both
are pretty high, considering this movie.
Especially with some of the numbers we've talked about, even Oscar movie numbers we've talked about. Those are trend on the higher
however,
side.
However, there's a however coming up.
Yeah, Metacritic. Okay. Annihilation is 79, but the cinema score was a C.
There it is.
A C.
Yeah. No, there it comes.
So first impression. IMDb has a 7.1 out of 10. That's solid. It's a mindfuck of a movie.
Right. The first impression after this movie is not great for anybody. Almost every critic I've watched on YouTube's like, yeah, I didn't love this movie after the first time. I don't know. I mean, I've only seen it twice, and I kind of loved it after both times. So,
so my first impression of it, or at least my expectation going in, to go way old school on you, for those of you that are familiar with our OSPs.
Did I overhype you?
No. It delivered the goods. Mm-hmm. I was disappointed in the ending because of reasons I'll get into in the spoiler section.
Okay, cool.
Plot, just to catch you guys up to speed, a comet with extraterrestrial life, or is it, hits the Earth at a lighthouse in rural coastal America in the Southern Reach and lands inside a lighthouse, and this establishes ground zero. A shimmer expands from the crash site, and anyone who investigates it does not return, including lack of radio communication. It does come to be known, as a matter of fact, as the shimmer. Some government agency headed by Dr. Ventress, who, as also Mike said, played by Jennifer Jason Leigh, sends in teams of drones and then men, again with nobody able to return except for one. The husband of Natalie Portman, Oscar Isaac, comes back after a year being lost in the Shimmer, which has now expanded many square miles, so it is growing. After an emotional reunion with his wife, Natalie, Oscar Isaac's character has a seizure. The government intercepts the ambulance on the way to the hospital, and Natalie Portman and Oscar Isaac are brought to Dr. Ventress's base of operations just outside and with access to the Shimmer. Isaac's health is in critical condition. He is not awake for the first part of this movie, and as a physicist and former Army General Captain, she was in the armed forces. Portman agrees to become part of the next all-female team to investigate the Shimmer, along with Gina Rodriguez and Jennifer Jason Leigh's characters, to figure out what is happening inside the alien territory expanding inside of our own American soil. So, who's going to make the obvious comparison to the Ghostbusters reboot? You or me?
What's that?
When they were all walking in with the proton packs into the Shimmer, the five women. Now, look, it's not a Ghostbusters movie.
I didn't even think about that.
It was on the head for me.
Sure.
Because they had the double. It doesn't matter.
I don't think he caught that himself, Mr. Alex Garland.
Oh, yeah. Listen, there are people online that are all about it. It's very, at least to me, it seemed quite obvious.
Did you ever see him get interviewed, though? He's definitely serious. So he's like...
Well, Garland, actually, he was on the record saying he wanted a different ending.
I don't think this man's ever smiled, by the way, but keep going.
Probably not. B, thought this movie would be too smart, and he called it too smart for audiences to get. Bit pretentious. It is a thinking man's movie. He's not wrong. You do have to put thought into it. This plot is not... It's linear until it isn't, is a good way of describing it, I think. It's a pretty basic what the fuck is going on premise.
Right.
This team of scientists and armed personnel, all women, I'm just going to refer to them as scientists because that's what they are, go in. They are trying to find out where everyone's gone, why people haven't been coming back. Yeah. What you discover as they're in there is that each scientist that goes on this trip has been specially selected by Jennifer Jason Leigh's character because they have pretty much not a desire to die, but no will to live anymore.
It's amazing because you get the premise. You're like, okay, heroes. And then it kind of flips it on its head a little bit because, of course, if you actually think about the premise for a second, they're going on a suicide mission by the rules of the premise, by the rules of the exposition.
And you wonder why they're so okay with this. Like, there is no fanaticism by these five scientists as to why they're going in. They're excited to go in. They want to see what's in there and what's going on.
So as science fiction premises go, I mean, this is a pretty solid one, just as a premise.
Hollywood keeps making the same movie. No, you're absolutely right. Let's talk about production values overall. I know I just said it in Veronica, but the cinematography in this is outstanding. That's not The Shiner, though. Go ahead. I know you want to talk about
the sound. I love the score.
Oh, it's so good. It's so good.
It's haunting and weird. It fits this movie and the plot so well. I'm a huge fan of all the sound effects. Whenever that score really gets that score, that snore, whenever that score really gets going, man, it just, you get like goosebumps at times.
And the songs they play, the songs they play, the soundtrack to it, it's almost, it has like a folksy kind of tone to it at times. It's like a single string guitar or a picking guitar.
Yeah.
It's not like this heavy onset thriller sci-fi music that you're accustomed to.
Well, yeah, you got what, Crosby, Stills, and Nash in the middle of it, like with that great song.
That's... My mother came through. She's like, "Is that Simon and Garfunkel?"
That's nice. What are you watching?
Yeah, exactly. No, Mom.
The production design should and could be recognized at the end of the day here. I mean, we've talked about shots and the mise-en-scene. We've talked about Shape of Water getting a lot of credit, right?
Yes.
But the visual effects in this movie work within the
whole
because...
I had set design, too, as a highlight
as
well.
They literally shimmer. Like, all the visual effects, when you get them, like, there's a shine to it. There's, like, this... And it looks fantastic. But never mind that. Just the way they colored up this forest, the way they made that work in something different than actual real swampland for reasons that we'll get into in spoilers,
I
guess.
The way the beach is laid out towards the end and how it's decorated, yeah, for sure.
Production design, I mean, if this movie may fall off the map, totally fall off the map, but if they're actually picking best production designs of the year at the end of the day, this movie should be in consideration.
I would argue set design too, even though those tend to historically go to period pieces.
Sure.
I had a problem, one of my worst scenes, I had a problem with some of the visual effects. The two deer-like creatures that gallop off, they looked so CGI'd to me. It kind of took me out. Not a big deal. Didn't take me out of the movie
right.
or the plot at all.
Yeah, I can't argue with you there.
But look, we laid it out pretty much as well as we can without getting into spoilers, right? Do you want to just hop in?
I would just say that I think that this movie has a lot of Easter eggs in it. There's a lot of little details. It's another one of those kind of movies.
Tons.
And, you know, I like those kind of movies if you've listened to us by now. But the symbolism is perhaps the most interesting thing about it because you're just trying to ask questions.
Interesting and the most frustrating.
What does this mean? What does that mean? Yeah, and the deep dive into that fact is great. So from the glasses of water to the lighthouse to the infinity snake tattoos, all kinds of videos on YouTube go into it. I don't necessarily believe, and we may paraphrase some of them, but I don't think they hit it. And we watched a lot of them today. I don't think they've hit all the meanings of it because they kind of give you a surface level, you know, A equals B equals C, but they don't have the causality down. They don't have the full scope of the symbolism.
Yeah, in the way that I keep gushing about film critic Hulk's review of Mulholland Drive and how much that helped shape my take on it and what we discussed about in our review of it way back in episode 9, I think, I am equally discouraged by the things I saw and read today in regards to people's takes on this movie, the reviews of this movie. I'm with you. I don't think there's a firm grasp of everything that's going on. Not to say we're right, but we'll see as we get into it.
So yeah, strong performances. Gina Rodriguez, like we said, Natalie Portman. Gina Rodriguez is going to be Carmen Sandiego for a reason.
I saw that.
She, I mean, she's getting a lot of star making roles.
I love her. I love America Ferrera too. I've gotten the superstar. I've said that. So.
So I guess the final thoughts for the non-spoilers here, Mike. I mean, if you love Mindbenders, if you love to see a movie,
I'm on the record over and over again. If a movie makes you think, it's a good thing. You should go see movies that make you think. So yes.
So I don't know if it's on the level of Moon, Solaris, 2001: A Space Odyssey, 28 Days Later. Even or Ex Machina, I have opinion on it. I'll say it in spoilers, but this is a welcome addition to great science fiction filmmaking for me. I mean, is it a great movie overall? I would say no, but I think it's a strong movie and it's some fun science fiction. If you need that fix, it's a different kind of movie than other brain busters we've done, for lack of a better word, like Mulholland Drive. It's not that, but
no.
It's kind of cool science fiction, thinking man science fiction.
Do you want to do grades before we jump into spoilers?
I gave it a B+ 88, tick above Veronica for me, and that was a strong grade.
I'm in the same ballpark. I'm a little below 86.
Oh, but you got okay, but yeah, we're both kind of in the ballpark. We both recognize a solid movie here, so I guess we got to break it down though, because it's a lot to break down.
Yeah, let's dance. Spoiler music. Spoilers ahead.
This is a spoiler warning.
Spoilers. 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 Spoilers.
Spoilers! All right, haven't done this in a while, but this is the spoiler section for Annihilation. We're doing our Netflix quarterly review here, and we are talking about Annihilation.
Did your eye just shimmer? Did, is this really you, or are you a duplicate?
I've been praying it hasn't been me for years.
Oh, my God.
If you're looking for any of the non-spoiler section, the production value specs, anything else to do with this movie, that's in the previous, I would say, 10, 15 minutes. I didn't time it, so whatever. Go back and listen to that before that hardcore techno beat got into your hearts and souls.
We'll have it in the show notes.
If you want the spoiler section for Annihilation.
Somebody read my show notes.
Sorry, this is where you need to be. So spoilers for Annihilation. Oscar Isaac's not Oscar Isaac.
That southern accent is very weird because it goes in and out.
It is the biggest problem. It's the biggest puzzle piece I haven't put into my picture of this movie.
YouTube
yet.
Reviewers say that he takes the southern accent from other characters in his team, but I think he has a southern accent. I got an ear for accents. In that first scenes with Natalie Portman, he has a southern accent.
I agree with you. I agree with your take there, yes.
So he's southern, so that's fine.
Yes.
But it's just like weird that he plays
so hardcore.
Well, I know why, because he's a duplicate in a bunch of those scenes. But why in the scenes where he's not a duplicate in those flashbacks does he not have a big southern accent?
So for those of you that have seen the movie or need a refresher on the plot or haven't seen it or aren't interested, the spoiler is that, like we said, Natalie Portman and Oscar Isaac had gone into the Shimmer and is the only person that made it out. Natalie Portman and Oscar Isaac's marriage has fallen apart completely. She wants to go in the Shimmer, A, to see what's going on, B, because she doesn't care anymore.
He goes into the Shimmer himself because he recognizes, and it's very obvious, that she's having an affair while he's away on one of his missions. So that kind of – and he doesn't blame her. It's not a big fight or anything necessarily. I don't remember if it was in the book either. I read the first book or listened to the first book. It's kind of a hard listen, but – he goes into the Shimmer knowing full well that she's having an affair and is very cold to her in that scene.
But now on the trail of Oscar Isaac's character in the Shimmer, Oscar Isaac, dubiously named Cain, by the way, his character, that always ends well.
So how does every YouTube reviewer not mention biblical proportions and biblical symbolism?
Because they got beat to death with it by mother, I'm guessing.
I guess.
Oscar Isaac's Cain character leaves clues and videos behind. Natalie Portman's Lena character finds. She finds one of him cutting open his buddy, his stomach, and seeing the intestines
Oof,
move around.
Brutal.
But he's not. Nobody's grossed out by it. They're excited to see what's going on. They have very curious looks on their face. Eventually, all things lead to this lighthouse, which is, like we said, ground zero for this meteorite or whatever the hell it is that happened. Natalie Portman enters, Lena enters, and eventually is fighting with her duplicate. We learn that the Shimmer is a refraction of DNA and everything else that's in it. It takes the DNA of living things and refracts it. It duplicates it, but not completely. Mm-hmm. It leaves subtle differences. It changes certain things. The big scuttlebutt between everything we've read and heard in YouTube videos and columns, nobody can completely explain what the hell's going on and what the hell the duplicate means and all that. So I'll leave the floor to you if you want to start it off there.
Well, I think YouTube videos are ignoring some things. So maybe this will kind of flush my take on it. And plus, it's something new. I don't want to just go over what the YouTube videos have been talking about, because a lot of great videos out there. I thank those guys. I thank them on Twitter. But listen, nobody really gets into the self-fulfilling prophecy of all this. That is a major theme of the movie. It's a key to the fate of Ventress, the Jennifer Jason Leigh character. It's right front and center with Tessa Thompson. Basically, she, in her mind, wills herself to become one of the plant people, which I thought was a total creepy twist. I love the plant people. And she makes it happen. Those plants come out of her scars, where she'd been cutting herself, and where it's told to the audience that she was cutting herself. So self-fulfilling prophecy and that as an aspect of self-destruction, being the theme of the movie, and wrestling with that paradoxical problem at the core of all this, that is huge. That I don't see anybody talking about that. And the problem is, though, you have it in the scene with the guy's intestines, right? Because of course he's afraid that there's things crawling around his intestines. So to me, I read that scene as like that's a one maybe perhaps self-fulfilling prophecy. And then of course Tessa Thompson confirms it by becoming a plant person when she's seemingly saying goodbye as that happens to her. I just rambled.
No, I was taking your explanation in stride, because I view it a little differently. That's I true. Think there is an aspect, without question, of self-fulfilling prophecy and people's inherent need to self-destruct or annihilate themselves. Ha, sure. Ha, ha. I took it a little differently. I think the lighthouse is kind of the alien in itself. It's responsible. I think the shimmer is just kind of its reach.
It's symbolically important that the lighthouse is ground zero.
Right.
That's huge.
I would agree.
And I mean, again, I don't think this is an allegory, like where we're saying this thing equals this, and this is the whole symbolic puzzle that works.
Which is my
together.
Frustration.
And it's not.
I think the tools were here for this to be a grand statement of a movie. I just don't think. I think the director stopped short of that. I think the director, whereas Mulholland Drive, you could see Lynch's linear thinking, right? You could see the story he wanted to tell.
Yeah.
He uses subtext and he uses symbolism and all that stuff to tell it, but you could see his story.
He also uses another 30,000 batshit tools of his trade.
Right.
I mean, sure. That movie's nuts. This movie is more linear.
For a Dream, same thing. You could see that director's vision. It's done through batshit scenes and crazy stuff, but you see the story he wanted to tell. I don't know that this director had a message in his story. I think he just
I disagree.
See, I think he just wanted to make a movie. I think he could have made a message.
No, because the symbolic a web, you can totally see that all over the place.
But he leaves it so open-ended.
I don't think it's open-ended.
I think it is.
Well, here's let's get into some more context.
Let me tell you my take from the where the lighthouse stands. I think the lighthouse is a finishing point. I think it's the end point. I think the shimmer is a state of Darwinism. And I think it wants to eliminate.
Yeah, it's about growth.
It only wants to duplicate the worthy. It only wants to duplicate, because I think the Shimmer itself is an alien. And I think you get all these hints about what Natalie Portman says it when she's being interviewed. It didn't want to attack. It just wanted to change things. I think it wants to replicate whatever gets to there. I think it wants to repeat whatever makes it to the lighthouse.
Well, but here's the problem with that, because yes, people die and they get sucked into its, into the walls or whatever.
Yeah.
But I don't necessarily know if it's that decisive and it only duplicates the worthy, because every character that we've come across is duplicated in one way, shape, or form. And it's duplicated.
They're changed.
And there's echoes early.
They're changed.
But even with the girls that get killed, she's echoed in the bear, and everything's duplicated.
But
so that's the whole the point.
I disagree. I don't think
they all are duplicated.
I don't think they're duplicated. I think they're changed. I think it only wants to duplicate the Worthy, because we only know of one person that ever made the lighthouse. Well, two if you count Dr.
There's two.
Dr. I'm talking about
Kane and Lena. I want to hear it out. Flush it out for me.
I'm talking Kane and Lena are the only ones where successfully make it from the lighthouse back.
Because I'm on firm ground here. I'm still.
Oh, I don't think I am either. And clearly, you're poking holes already. But we only have known of three total people. One of which.
Explain the universe to me right now, Michael.
One of which, the Dr. Ventrell character, she is flawed.
Yeah.
She has cancer, which we find out.
Yeah.
She has studied the Shimmer forever.
Yes.
The only reason she makes it that far and she hasn't been picked off by evolution, by this Darwinism, is because she can kind of react before it throws something at her.
Well,
she
goes back to my self-fulfilling prophecy. What was talked about with the Jason Lee character and the quotes surrounding her is that, you know, Natalie Portman, there's like a big speech where one character says, this girl wants to fight it, and Jennifer Jason Leigh's character, Ventress, wants to face it.
Right.
So her self-fulfilling prophecy is she wants to get to the lighthouse and face this thing down.
And but that's does exactly she want to do that because she knows she wants to end it? Because I think she herself, being a flawed human, quote-unquote flawed because she has cancer, as compared to, let's say, a Natalie Portman character.
Well, even if she wants to end it, she doesn't end it. That's not her ending it. That's Natalie Portman's character ends it.
But does she end it, or is it supposed to end?
Natalie Portman's character ends the Shimmer at the end.
But does the Shimmer, I'm saying, does the Shimmer tear itself down?
Is Natalie it supposed Portman's to end? Character transits the self-destructive property that her cells that she's been talking about the whole
movie.
Okay,
so here's my theory. If that's true,
yeah,
I think Jennifer Jason Leigh's character wasn't supposed to make it to the lighthouse. I think that she did make it to the lighthouse, made the Natalie Portman replicant flawed when it's not supposed to be flawed. I think the originals are supposed to be changed and disposed. And I think the Shimmer is supposed to make these new origins that, whether you want to talk about they're repopulating the Earth or whatever, their Darwinism that they take to get to that point is...
I don't think you're wrong about
supposed
that, but
to come out
I just don't
people.
Think that's the final stage of the thematics or whatever you want to call them.
Well,
I think you're trying to nail that down because...
I'm trying to find a role for Jennifer Jason Leigh because she's not supposed to make it there. And I think without question, she is the reason that Natalie Portman's DNA ends up, A, Natalie Portman escaping, B, ends up ruining the Shimmer and destroying it.
Well, but the thing about Jennifer Jason Leigh is her, like the supposition you made is that she wants to stop it. I think she wants to face it like the movie told us she wants to do.
So what does facing it mean?
Face it down, figure it out. She wants to understand it. She doesn't necessarily want
to
stop it.
So to do that,
she
does what?
The one person with something to live for, she is turned into the Shimmer, into that glorious thing that's like her self-fulfilling prophecy, like I said. In my mind, she turns into this, you know, bizarro whatever that was. And I'm not saying I understand her to a degree, but the thing is, Natalie Portman actually wants to stop it. And she wants to stop it to get back to her husband, or even she knows it's a duplicate, to get back to her duplicate husband.
Yes, but so why?
She's the one person with something to live for.
What motivation would she have to get back to someone she knows isn't her husband?
And she confirms that motivation. I mean, listen, the motivation is complex. She confirms that motivation at the end when she's grateful to be with her husband and they actually have that conversation and that dynamic at the end. They're both eyes. They both shimmer a little bit. She wants to get out. And that whole sequence is her being a survivalist. Is her trying with, screams and being pushed up against the walls of it, trying to get out. And of course, she finally, her will, and you have to have a strong will protagonist, her strong will figures out that this thing is mimicking her, and she gets it to use that other plasma grenade to destroy itself because she understands the nature of it in the sense that it's not necessarily something with a complex mind that can have this intense motivation. It's basically mimicking human.
Yeah, I agree with that aspect of it. I don't think this thing has a point other than to do what it's doing. I don't think it's nefarious. I don't think it's evil.
Right. The Shimmer is not necessarily. That's why growth is not evil. Like human growth and human progress is not evil. I'm not saying equal signs. Again, it's not an allegory. However, the thing is, this Shimmer is that kind of a force.
But I think it wanted to eliminate... I think it wanted to only keep the stronger people.
I don't think you're wrong about that. I think that I'm with you on that. I'm just saying the strongest person in this example was Natalie Portman. And
I would agree.
For many reasons, and one of them is that she's willing to shirk her self-destructive and recognize it, number one, recognize her self-destructive mentality or whatever that's underneath the surface, and she's willing to fight against that and then transit that property to this double. This is an amalgam of a lot of the YouTube videos, that final punch. That's an amalgam. They all tend to agree on the fact that she's, and I don't think you're wrong. The only thing I would contend with is that it's totally open-ended at the end. I don't think it's totally open-ended. I think it is.
I think the motivation,
she is not a duplicate.
I think what happened to her is
how do you mean it's open-ended? I don't understand why you mean it's open-ended.
In terms of making an allegory, I think it's open-ended. I think if you're trying to find...
Yeah, it's not an allegory.
Right, that's what you said. So I guess I'm coming to that. Yeah.
We both agree.
I guess I'm saying that this could have been...
Can we be friends
again? I mean, this could have been about the cancer that humanity is on natural resources. This could have been about needing to change the way of we live in order to survive and make the planet happen. It could have been about air pollution. It could have been about global warming.
Yeah.
And I think in that way... And that's what I mean. I think the auteurs of these thinking piece movies, the David Lynch's, the Requiem for the Dream... They have a message. They have a deeper meaning. Yeah. I don't know that he does.
Let me give you my next five tenets of the symbolism here, because I wrote them all down. Like I said, the self-fulfilling prophecy was kind of a motif that I thought bound them all together. But I mean, in terms of the context of the environment, global warming and climate change are all over the place. That symbolism is all over the place.
I agree. Obviously, I'm not saying it's not present. I agree.
You know, humanity growing exponentially over the last, you know, a couple hundred years.
But Mike, you're making my point.
Right.
You're making my point. Because all those hallmarks are present. That's what I mean.
That's why I keep telling you the point is we don't disagree. I'm just saying.
My point is he has the tools to make any of those statements.
He's making all of those statements.
But you can't make all those statements.
It's weak. He's making those statements and he's doing
Jack of all trades, master of none.
In drips and
drops. That's exactly what this is.
No, I don't think so. Because
that's how I take it.
Listen, the ultimate problem I would ask you is that we may know the ending, but that's so ironic because right from the beginning, he gives you the last scene of the movie, right?
Right.
He gives you the start of the last sequence before she goes and reunites with her duplicate husband. But that's also like a huge philosophical question. They ask you right from the beginning, is the ultimate problem that we know the ending? And I would say yes, everybody dies. I mean, simple as that. But that is a major philosophical premise that they're just hammering out and really in a fun way there. But look at biblical. This is not a new theme. There's the tree of knowledge and good and evil, the Adam and Eve story. It's all over there. His name is Cain, for God's sake. So I'm right about that. I mean, but that's fascinating imagery. Listen, historically... historical symbolism, the lighthouse being a symbol for ground zero here is super significant because colonialism, you know, the expansion to the new world, I think that's all going on. Again, human progress, but let's say one last thing. I mean, mystical. Does Lena really save her husband? You know, his organ failure was complete, right?
Mm-hmm.
He had complete organ shutdown. So what she does actually saves her husband. So she transits those properties, he being a, you know, person of the shimmer, he goes from total organ shutdown to walking and talking around. That can't happen. She had to have transited that property. So what I'm saying is the stakes of this movie and the ending of this movie, you have clear causality. That's all I'm trying to say. I mean, is
You're
he making
guy,
a single statement about reality? No, he's making 10 statements.
And that weakens it to me. You're the guy that talks about A storylines, then B, C storylines.
But they all kind of
you go, if you
they
go
all
to David
kind of
Lynch,
come together, though, is what I'm saying.
But like, if you go to David Lynch and you say, what is Mulholland Drive about? Well, don't go to David Lynch. But if you go to somebody that knows, they're going to tell you it's about this woman's dealing with her personal relationships. That's what Mulholland Drive's about. If you go to the Requiem for a Dream, what's that about? It's about drug abuse, right? The evils of drug
self-destruction.
Abuse.
They're both about self. Okay. All three are about self-destruction.
If you talk to this, what this movie is about, you just said, well, it's about global warming. It's about overpopulation. It's about evolution.
It's about self-destruction. That's the theme. It's the same theme of Mulholland Drive. It's the same theme of Requiem for a Dream. Then it's the same theme. It's getting at it in all the different ways. You can't tell me that Mulholland Drive's David Lynch doesn't get at it about 1,000 different ways.
He's telling the same message.
Right.
This guy is.
There's nobody more nonlinear than David Lynch, with more symbolism than David Lynch, with more types of symbolism than David Lynch. You can't love that movie and hate this one.
I don't hate this one.
Right.
I think it's a good movie.
But I think it's
disappointing in the end.
That the web of symbolism is working together, and he's making a cogent point.
And again, we're agreeing, but just being loud about it. I think choosing to have those things work together weakens the impact of the movie.
I don't think you can say that after loving David Lynch, who chooses so many nonsense things that should never have been able to work together and make your
point.
But he
did it with one major plot line, with one major message.
That it took you 20 years to figure out.
That's
not the point. It took me 20 years to figure out.
That's not the point. Well, then if you're saying that maybe I just don't get this yet, then maybe that's true.
I don't know if that's the true. What I'm saying is, so far you're hitting on things, but why would you say it's totally open-ended? I think it's very clear at the end.
Because all the tools were there for this to be such a radical statement and such a unique way to make a statement about one of these things. And instead, you're basically saying A, B, C, D, E, F, the world's fucked up and we're fucked up as humans, which isn't false.
It's much more complex.
Well, yes, it is. It is much more complex.
This is not making a simple statement. It's much more complex, which I appreciate is what I'm saying. And it's not open-ended. It's very clear that all these narrative tools are being used.
The main message that you take away from this movie is open-ended.
I don't think so.
What's the main message of this movie?
The main message of the movie is to overcome your self-destructive tendencies.
As what, a society?
As a society, as a human being,
as
interpersonal? No, overcome your self-destructive tendencies. That's the paradoxical dilemma posed at the beginning of the movie. They actually give you dialogue on it throughout, and I think that's the main thing for Mulholland Drive. That's the main thing for Requiem for a Dream. And I do think that these last five tenets of symbolism, I'm using big philosophy class words here, but
show off.
No. The environment, you know, the global warming is symbolically or literally us killing ourselves, right? It's us self-destructing as a species. The Bible ends in the book of Revelation. It's the humanity, again, as a species in a religious sense, self-destructing. Historically, you know, the lighthouse being some kind of symbol for expansion to the new world, et cetera, in a loose way. Again, global expansion, that leads to global warming. So you can, mystically, I think, Lena saving her husband, her mate, really? I mean, it's her husband. So that gives you a silver lining at the end that she's hopefully getting past the self-destruction to rejoin him.
So I can understand it in my futile brain. You're saying basically that, yes, it is commenting on all these things, global warming, globalization, et cetera, but the theme
is not open-ended. Maybe the plot is a little open-ended. I will grant you that.
You're saying his message is, again, self-fulfilling prophecy, that humans need to change their ways.
Right. We need to overcome the self-fulfilling prophecies that are bogging us down right now. I mean, that's a simplification. Simplification of it, but... That's what I think he's saying.
I think I could buy that. I think it changes my stance.
And I don't think anybody on YouTube is really saying that. I think I'm...
I've seen it alluded to. I have. And I've seen...
Damn it. I thought I had some.
Well, no, I have seen it alluded. But I don't think I've seen it as well argued. And I don't think I've seen it as well thought out.
You're a good guy and a good friend.
I'm serious. I do certainly think it was well argued.
I tried.
I think you...
I wrote down six tenets. Did I tell you?
It really angers me. I like being right. I don't like being wrong.
No, listen. You're editing. You didn't watch it enough. And I'm probably
you're
wrong.
You're giving me such an out.
You didn't watch it enough. You've seen Mulholland Drive how many times?
I think I need to.
You've seen it 20 times.
To go away.
You watch a movie about suicide 25 times. How do you do that? Yeah. You have to watch this one. Again, a couple times, a couple more.
I will, and I will. I will come back with reasons you're wrong.
Might probably gonna happen. Probably gonna happen, as is Twitter gonna come at me.
I don't think you're wrong in anything you've said. I think it's a matter of perspective as look, far as what you value.
I don't have a great message. Feel on this movie yet.
No, I don't
know
either.
How we disagreed
either.
On it hard, and I don't think we really did.
No, we're just idiots. We're loudly agreeing with one another in very angry tones.
I don't know. Awkward laughter.
See, I think just to put a bow on this ridiculous argument where we agree with each other, I think my problem with it is that saying that humans need to change their ways or humans are bad for the planet as a general idea is so simplistic in a movie that has all the tools to make this mind fuck and this crazy journey.
Again, I think it's more complex than that. But I'll grant you this because I have to reexamine my own grade, if nothing else, and my own thoughts on the movie here. If this movie successfully told the human race to overcome its self-destructive nature in such a forceful way that made us all cheer at the end, I think I'd give it more than a B plus 88. So you might be right. Yes, the symbolism stacks. Yes, I think it feeds into a main idea, but necessarily does it execute it to perfection? I don't know. I mean, it's still elusive.
So in summary, Alex Garland needs to write better for us personally.
Maybe simpler for us because we didn't get it.
Yes. This movie was too smart for audiences.
Grant gestures.
Like you said, you were a B plus 88. I was a B 86. That's what we got. That's our. We went long on this as we tend to do on the Netflix reviews, but it's going to happen. We hope you can find some gold to dig this up with. You can get at us. Let us know if any of these recommendations or any of these stayaways had an impact on you. If you think we're wrong or right on anything, let us know. If you have anything to say about Annihilation after listening to the spoiler section, clearly I'm way off base here. Mike might be closer to the
disagree.
Truth than me.
I don't know. Maybe you're right.
Let us know, Mike, and Oscar on Facebook. Mike,
Alex Garland's next interview is like, I wanted to leave it entirely open-ended. I don't know. Maybe I missed that interview.
I have to cancel Alex Garland about after this day. But I did give it an 86. It's a good movie. It's a go watch it.
We're weird.
Mike and Oscar on Facebook. Mike and Oscar on Instagram. MM and Oscar on Twitter. Mike and Oscar at gmail.com. Mike and Oscar on Reddit. Website coming soon. Sorry for going long, but we had a lot to fill in and we wanted to get it all done in one shot. So hopefully this gives you a little satisfaction to go through this week with. Reality sucks, guys. Keep watching movies with us. We'll check you out next time. Don't flip your mattress.
No, don't flip your mattress. Good job. See ya.